writers and curious readers coming to you from Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a new interview with the author Zoe Zollbrod. Zoe Zollbrod's work has appeared in Salon, The Nervous Breakdown, The Weaklings, and The Rumpus, where she serves as Sunday co-editor. Her debut novel, Currency, won a 2010 Nobby Award and received an honorable mention by Friends of American Writers. Zollbrod lives in Evanston, Illinois, with her husband and children. Her new book is The Telling, a memoir published by Curbside Splendor. For most of her childhood, Zoe Zollbrod kept a complicated and troubling secret. Between the ages of 4 and 5, she was routinely molested by her teenaged cousin. When she finally decided to talk about it, she wasn't sure what to expect, what to say, or who to tell. Through a kaleidoscopic series of experiences, Zollbrod hitchhikes with a boyfriend from one coast to another, hangs out in a strip club in Philadelphia, tends bar in Chicago, meets and marries her husband, and gives birth to her children. She traces the development of her sexuality, her relationships with men, and the cultivation of her motherhood in the shadow of her childhood sexual abuse. Bolstered with research, Zollbrod argues passionately for the empowerment of sexual abuse victims and the courage it takes to talk about it. The Telling is an intimate examination of one woman's reckoning with a past she can't always explain and a life lived in search for the right words. When I spoke with Zollbrod, I began by asking her when her ability to tell became an ability to write about sexual molestation, and when did that become a desire to write a book?
It was a slow process, so I did a fair amount of journaling about it after the events that opened the book, after I found out that the person who did this to me was now in jail. Mm-hmm. On trial for doing it to someone else 25 years later. Mm-hmm. So I did a lot of journaling about it, and that corresponded with a time in which I was not doing a lot of writing for publication because I just had a baby. I was having a hard time adjusting to parenting and working, and I was depressed about not writing. And then it was about 5 years later that I went away for a weekend and looked at all the journals I'd been keeping and realized that actually I had been writing a great deal. Of course, this was just for private consumption.
Right.
But that's when I sort of made the decision to try to write with more intention about this, with the possibility of publication. And it still took me some years after that to really find a voice for the book. I started like dropping breadcrumbs in essays, I would say.
Right. Okay. And I have read some of your Salon essays. I wonder, can you talk a little bit about taking your journal writings and turning those into memoir, which, as you say, went from being private to for the public to read?
From those journals, from the kind of the adult journals, I'm going to call them, I didn't actually use much of the writing there.
Okay. It
was really just me working through my feelings about this.
Yes.
And retracing the timeline and so forth. Journals I relied on a little more in some ways were journals I kept as a younger adult when I had that sort of crisis around mm-hmm. this issue when I was about 25.
Mm-hmm.
I was really surprised at the quality of the writing there, and I leaned more heavily on those during the actual writing from the periods of that time in my life.
Yeah. Okay. I'll just recap the subject of the book, which is that you were, it's your life story to some extent, but you were molested by a cousin who came to live with your family for a time, and he came because he was getting in trouble and his own parents couldn't handle him. So, I was struck. It's funny. One of your reviewers said something about your grace and restraint, and I was struck by how calm your voice was in this book in recounting the story. It seemed to me like you could have felt incredibly angry at so many people, you know, your cousin, of course, but also the adults who put him in your path or just maybe weren't watching very closely enough, or you could have sort of, in retrospect, felt that way. Did you avoid writing about anger, or have you just sort of worked through it, or were you really this restrained, as that reviewer said, in your reaction?
I think it might almost be... some might point to it as a symptom.
Mm-hmm.
that I really never did have a lot of anger per se around this. It comes out more when I think about it happening to other people, to the point where my voice can even get shaky if I'm talking about hearing about this happening to someone else. And I think that's what flipped the switch in me when I learned that he had continued to do this to other little girls. But for some reason, with regard to myself, I felt a lot of different emotions, and anger was not at the forefront.
Yeah, and it does make a lot of sense that once you heard that he was on trial for doing this to other children, that that would be the thing that that pushed you into some sort of action. So the book also talks a lot about your life and your relationships, starting when you're pretty young. I really enjoyed, there's this great moment for me in the book when you're in your 20s, you're hanging out with a group of people, and some of the women are working at a local strip club. And you're encouraged by your friends to do that, to strip for earning some money. And, you know, it wasn't a big deal to them, and it wasn't really a big deal to you that they were doing it either. But I loved this line. You said, "I knew my comfort in my body would be mitigated by judgment, the judgment of the people watching, and that the defenses I'd need to build up against it and against monetized interest and stolen gropes would alienate me from my newfound ability to see sexual energy as a fuel for anarchic revolution rather than a ball in the Bobby Riggs Billie Jean King tennis match." That's kind of a long sentence, actually, to read on the radio, but it was a great sentence. I really loved that description and how it placed us in time. Bobby Riggs and Billie Jean King, that put me right back there. But I wanted to talk about sexual energy as a fuel for what you called anarchic revolution, and how you came to feel that way.
Well, that was at a time, I think I was exactly 20 years old, and I was in college at Oberlin College, a very liberal place. I'd already been predisposed in these directions, but that's a real hotbed of sort of radical thinking, political thinking. I've been a nascent feminist, but I had all these resources there to really dive in as deep as I wanted to into various strains of feminism. And then I was hanging out in Philadelphia with a lot of people who identified themselves as anarchists. I was learning about that. And it was an exciting time for me. And I was having really hot sex, so it all seemed of a piece, you know.
Right. Was your mother at all a feminist, or was she sort of very much of an earlier time?
Sort of a combination. She was definitely influenced by the 70s. I remember very vividly that we grew up in a small town. It was an unsophisticated place. My mom is a reader, and she was affected by the popularization of feminism and consciousness raising groups and so forth. Not to an extreme degree, but she did a slideshow at the Unitarian Church to Helen Reddy's
I'm Woman.
Yeah. And I remember helping her pick out the slides. So I was definitely exposed to the concept that women were fighting for equality.
Yeah. Okay. I loved a description that you include in the book of the war between the sexes. You said it felt like each side trying to get what they want without having things taken against their will. I thought that was really good way to put it. I suppose you could see that describing other conflicts too, but I liked that. Now, your perspective was sometimes so balanced, it took me by surprise. At one point you wrote, "I have sympathy for the fact that presumed sexual guilt is something men have to walk around with, something that complicates their taking on more public caretaking roles." And then later you wrote about your own experience, I wanted this section of the book to be about how not that bad being sexually abused was, about the ways it was empowering even, because it was empowering in some ways. I want to believe that, and I do. For one thing, I became practiced in refusing someone whose breath I could feel on my skin, which would prove helpful when I was old enough to decide who to let close but no closer and when to say no. So I wondered, as you wrote the book, did you find that balance through writing, or did you sort of all, had you kind of arrived there earlier?
I think actually, and I hope I'm revealing somewhat in that section, I really had and continue to have to some degree a vested interest in thinking that it wasn't that bad and that I did gain something from these experiences. And I actually came to question that in the writing, and I had to let down some of my guard. You know, I think it's a guarded position, and I continue to be sort of mixed on it, to be honest, basically as I say there, because I did, you know, I've been very lucky in the rest of my dealings with men and sexuality, and I did feel a lot of agency, and who knows where that came from. But it benefited me. It made me feel stronger to think that I had taken these lemons and made lemonade from them.
I think that just as a reader of memoir, I found it a relief, or is that the right word? I found it refreshing that there was that balance. I feel like sometimes authors of memoir need to work a little more at presenting their stories for the reader and not just for the author. Does that make sense?
Yeah, not just working through their own injuries, but presenting it in a broader context, perhaps.
Right.
Is what you're saying?
Yes, that's true. That is what I'm saying. I'm wondering, do you get any sort of, so the book came out in May, do you get reactions from survivors of sexual abuse that are at all finding fault with the book or taking another perspective? Do any of them sort of call you out for your balance, as I was putting it before?
Yes, I've had some of those reactions, and I've had the opposite reactions too, where people sort of are complaining that it wasn't bad enough what happened to me. So I was, you know, aware that I might get criticisms on either of those two sides, and I have.
Yeah.
But luckily not in the reviews so much, I've had some really nice reviews, so it's mostly people contacting me or indirect channels, reviews on Goodreads or something like that.
Right. Oh, that's good. I'm glad that people are being respectful in that way, because I think that sometimes those reviews can be really hard.
Oh, well, let me clarify. Some of the reviews on Goodreads and Amazon have been along those lines,
The
reviews by reviewers and publications have been kind.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right. You know, it is, you kind of, when you decide to write a memoir, you are kind of putting your story out there and opening it up to the public consumption. So it sounds like you're handling that pretty well, though. Is it just something that you sort of expect and you kind of move on?
You know, I did not know how I would respond. I was sick with nerves when this book came out, and it's been long enough now. I'm just pleased to see that I have a thicker skin than I expected. And it's helped so much by a few of the reviews have just meant the world to me to see that, you know, people I respect have totally understood the book and appreciate it and get from it what I had hoped. It gave me so much confidence that the criticisms have washed off my back fairly easily, and I've been able to keep away from a lot of them as well.
That's great. What you're saying reminds me of a section of the book. You are talking about friendships in the book and how some are easier or more comfortable than others. There's a scene where you're talking with three women who you describe as sharp, divorced moms, and you're talking about men and sex and male strippers. And you write, "I'm conscious of how fresh the conversation seems in comparison to those I have with married women in my neighborhood and at school functions. I'm aware of how familiar and foreign it is, a diet I used to live on and seldom taste now." And that made me wonder how exposed you feel now in neighborhood conversations and at school functions now that the book is out.
Well, you know, it's interesting to me because I was very nervous about that. I express in the book, have this feeling of being something of an outsider, even though I really live a very conventional life and mm-hmm. a very upright person in most ways. But I often have that feeling of being something of an outsider, and I think it's been sort of a relief to me to have the book out and to have the people around me supporting me through it. They've been great. Mm-hmm. And I think to a large degree it's because we socialize with our children around us and we're protective of our children, and that affects the conversation, you know. And you can spend a lot of time with someone but not really have a chance to be truly intimate because of what's going on around you. And I think this has opened up some friendships, actually.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, you do, in part of the book, you do talk about being a mother and having, you know, your children. You have a boy and a girl, right? So, I mean, people who would read this book would appreciate that aspect of the memoir as well, the parenting aspect and what you're bringing to that section of the book. Did you do a lot of research in writing The Telling?
I did, yes.
And how did you approach your research?
Well, I really realized my deficits as a researcher. I'm so far out of school, and I was always in English literature and so forth. It's a different kind of research. I was a little bit out of my depth with some of the sociological research or statistics, but there are good sources online. It gave me a greater appreciation of the nuance for some of these things, mm-hmm. how hard it is to make certain statements. And also, I think it was a part of my writing process as well as my sort of psychological recovery process to do so much research and feel like I had that behind me, that I was standing on firm ground
right.
with regard to certain things, and that it was giving me a kind of larger purpose for the writing besides just poking at my own wounds.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any resources that you were particularly gratified that they existed other than just Google? I mean, is there anything in particular that you discovered in doing your research that, I guess I'm thinking like for listeners who are maybe doing research on books?
Let me see if I can remember. I think Bureau of Justice Statistics. I was surprised at how much information the government had available.
Yeah.
And it was really a treasure trove. It really, you know, it interested me. And I guess that was the biggest surprise and where I ended up spending the most time, because there was more than I thought, and I felt like it was pretty sound. And a lot of times I would read briefs by institutes or organizations, advocacy organizations, and it would give me some idea about what I wanted to look for, and then I could trace back into the government statistics or some more academic studies.
Right.
And having this, you know, having a more starting out with the layperson's description gave me a scaffolding when I started to look at material that was more dense and hard for me to recognize at first.
Yeah. Speaking of the research, you gave one statistic that just absolutely floored me. In 2014, the National Crime Victimization Survey found that as many as 38% of incidents of sexual violence were committed against men. And in just under half of these incidents, a woman was the violator. This just shocked me. Did that surprise you?
Yes, it did. I think it surprised a lot of people. There was a little flurry about it. There were a number of articles about it. And, you know, part of me... it's still a little disbelieving, but then I'll tell you what, a lot of the people who've approached me about the book to talk to me about their own experiences have been men. I'd say in terms of people who have approached me, it's 50-50.
Really?
So that's just anecdotal support for that statistic, I suppose.
Yeah.
And that men have felt even less invited or even less able to discuss it, and I think that's changing somewhat now, and hope that it continues to change.
Right. Now, I remember you pointed out in the book that men were less likely to report sexual abuse because they might be ashamed by victimhood or fearful that they wouldn't be believed. And in the case of being sexually molested by another man, they were fearful that they might be, you know, labeled as gay by their friends if they're young, all of which is just sad. Sort of do hope it's changing.
Yeah, and I know I just heard a story from someone who was gay, and it can complicate your feelings about your sexuality further,
mm-hmm.
too. You know, not just the fear of being called gay, which is one fear, but also the fear of actually being gay.
Or questioning the validity of something.
Yeah.
Now, later in the book, you mentioned that online statistics are often overly simplified to be digested easily by lay people who are reading. And then you give this list of statistics, and it really kind of jumped out at me because it was very different style from the rest of the book, this list of statistics. Some of them were 1 out of 4 children in the U.S. is being raised by a single parent. More than 1 out of 5 lives in families with incomes below the federal poverty limit. 1 in 5 will be sexually abused. One out of three has a college degree, and so on. Do you think these statistics, do you think when we read these things, it gives us a clearer picture of our world, or do you think we sort of go, wow, and then move on and kind of forget about it?
That's a good question. I know for myself, I kept coming back to them.
Yeah.
So I think we can say, wow, and move on, but we tend, I think, and now more than ever, I think statistics show we live in more homogenous groups socioeconomically and so forth, and
right.
it's, and I think people with more sort of take up more space and attention in our media culture still, even in, you know, who do I focus on, people who have things I want much more so than people who have less than we do. I see that with my kids as well. Everyone has an iPhone, you know.
Yeah.
it's not true. So I think it is easy to gloss over them, but I keep coming back to them to kind of position myself, try to keep some perspective.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're listening to Write the Book and a new interview with the author Zoe Zollbrod, whose new memoir is The Telling, published by Curbside Splendor. If you're enjoying the podcast, I would love it if you would go to iTunes and rate it. Pass along the show's information to some friends. Go to Facebook and like us, and watch us on Twitter. Thanks and keep listening. All right. A big piece of the memoir has to do with a relationship that you had with a man that is named Carl in the book. I don't know if you changed names.
I did.
People. Yeah. And you and Carl, for example, hitchhiked across the country, and you spent a lot of time together. He was one of the first people who you did tell about being molested. And I really liked this honest revelation that you make at one point. After he knows that you were molested, he actually meets Toshi, your cousin, and you write, "I wanted to create the opportunity for Carl to call me out because in the context of that relationship and that summer, I was almost proud of having been molested." And you reveal that you were pantomiming awkwardness and resentment at that moment. I thought that was so honest and so courageous to admit. I wanted to talk about the courage that it takes to make honest statements in a memoir. We sort of talked a little bit about this before, but do you have anything that you would add?
Well, I think as you read there, he was someone who was less privileged than me. And those statistics you read earlier, many of them reflect his
right.
circumstances. And I wanted to feel like something other than just the lucky middle class girl with
right.
loving parents.
Right. I didn't put that in context when I read it. But he was raised by a single mom and he was living below the poverty limit, I believe. And
Yeah. But in terms of me talking about it in the memoir, well, it was just really my project to understand myself and my own relationship to this fact of my life as clearly as I could.
Mm-hmm.
And I just can't understand it clearly without investigating all the complexities around it. Always in relation to what society was, what I was gleaning from society, that what was the normal narrative around molestation versus what I was actually feeling. And I just really wanted to peel away as many layers as possible.
Yeah. Now, so there's that aspect of it where you are experiencing the writing of the book and kind of going through your life and thinking about how you want to present it to the public. But then there's the experience of having it edited. And I wondered how that was. Like, what was that like? Was that hard? Did you have to cut anything that you felt was key to your story? And do you think editors are more understanding with their authors when it's memoir?
I did reach a point, I really love my editor, Naomi Hoffman, and I got a lot of feedback from my writing group before that, and in particular, Gina Frangello, a good friend of mine and a great writer. We've worked with each other's writing for almost 20 years now. So she did an edit for me, and I've worked with Gina so closely over such a long time, I found that a little bit easier, but as publication got closer, I was getting more and more nervous. And
right.
And Naomi did a really beautiful edit, but I did freak out. I did have a freak out. Right toward the end there, I just was super sensitive in ways that I'm not usually. And I did at times feel very defensive about a small phrase here or there, you know, because I was like, this is the way I felt. And because just I was trying so hard to be honest.
Right.
It was such a project for me. And so sometimes someone changing just three words would set me off because I had fought so hard to find what I felt was the truth about my feeling.
Yeah.
Even a slight change in wording, you know, might just get my alarm bells ringing. That's not true. That's not the way it was. Or I was worried that people would want it to be different than what it actually was for me. I realized I was saying some things that were bordering onto taboo, perhaps, that were against the grain. And but we worked through it. Naomi's a lovely person. We met in person. She was so sensitive and understanding, and I felt good about it in the end, but there were a good 2 weeks there where I was probably driving all my friends and my spouse nuts with my
Well, I can
my
see
anguish.
Why. Yeah, I would think that it would be particularly nerve-wracking to publish a book that is just so, that makes you so vulnerable, at least for a time,
mm-hmm.
Even if ultimately it's freeing. Did you, as you were working on it, did you treat Zoe in the book as a character, maybe to gain some distance from a craft perspective, or was that really not part of your thinking?
I'd say in the sections that deal with the past, more so. So as you see, the chapters sort of vary, or not sort of vary, they do vary in terms of time and the way in which they're related. And some of them are more essay-like, I would say, where it really is me as a writer exploring things or working things through,
mm-hmm.
Examining ideas even. And some of them are more narrative. And in those ones, often when I'm younger, I think I did approach the protagonist more as a character.
Right.
I'm in the hitchhiking sections, for example.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like there are chunks of your childhood that you kind of had forgotten. And I'm wondering if some of that had to be recreated, or did you just not write stuff that you couldn't remember very well, even if you'd heard stories from other people?
I tried. I want to be clear that there was never a point at which I did not know that this had happened to me.
Right.
I didn't discover the memories of being molested. They were always with me.
Right.
I didn't know quite what to make of them. But I tried to acknowledge in the book when I didn't know something and when I was imagining what might have happened. I did try to flag things I was unsure about. And I'm sure I have made errors because memory is a slippery thing. And in a couple cases, I was so sure of something, and then I would find documentation in the form of a journal entry or just some research about what was going on at that time, and find I was wrong, and they were memories I would have sworn were correct.
Isn't that strange when that happens?
Yeah.
Okay, how did you go about deciding what the structure of the book would be? Did you play with various structures, or was it always this structure?
It was always mixed chronologically.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I didn't want it to be a straight forward chronological retelling. But I wasn't sure, for instance, whether or not I would put those more researched listy chapters in or not.
Right.
And there was a lot of fiddling with which chapter should go where.
Right. And the book is structured in three parts. So even though it moves around in chronology, you have youth and adulthood and family. So were you kind of writing all kinds of stuff and then putting it into different order as you figured out what you wanted to do? Or did you always know that those would be your three sections?
I did not know that those would be my three sections, but I knew I wanted one through line. You know, I got a little esoteric about this with color-coded outlines and so forth.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So to me, there is kind of there's momentum, there's a narrative thrust, but it's only in one of the sets of chapters,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense. Not one of the sections, because as you say, there are three sections, each of which contain 10 to 15 chapters, I think.
Right. Right, and they are really chapters. It didn't feel like I was reading standalone essays. This definitely felt like it all leaned on itself as a full piece. Did you publish any of it separately?
You know, I published one, but I thought when I started writing, I wanted to publish essays along the way.
Mm-hmm.
But it ended up being harder than I thought, because as you say, they're more chapters than essays, and I think they lost some power when standing alone.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up publishing one after the book was finished, and then I published one as what it is, an excerpt. But minimally.
Okay. At what point did it come to be important to you that a large part of the book's focus and even its title were on telling? When did that present itself as essential to you in the course of writing the book?
It was there from the beginning.
It was.
I started, the first thing I wrote was the first time I'd ever told someone. And I had always planned on structuring it around the different times I told people sort of what was going on in my life and what was going on in the culture and society at the time. In fact, I think at the beginning it leaned even more heavily on that
mm-hmm.
idea than it came to in the end.
Mm-hmm. I love, this is, you know, sometimes I bring this up during an interview. It's not necessarily vital, but I love your cover. You must also love your cover, I presume. I can't imagine.
I do.
Yeah. It's a kind of city scene, but the forefront is a bird on a branch. Were you surprised by this cover, or did you know what they were working on?
I was not surprised at all, because it's an image of my husband's.
Oh.
And they had asked for some image ideas, and this was a second round. And it was meaningful to me, because my husband had a difficult time with this memoir. He had a hard time reading it. It was difficult material for him to consider.
Sure.
And that did create something of a strain between us, because I was, you know, I was consumed with the ideas in it and so forth. And it really brought us together when we looked through his artwork together with the eye toward choosing something that might work for the book, and it gave me a chance to talk to him about a lot of the themes and what things meant to me, and he was really able to enter into it then. It felt like a real partnership in choosing something. I was mm-hmm. so glad they selected this,
mm-hmm.
and I love what the designer did with it, Robin
yeah.
Fisher.
And I love the way that the font ties in with the little flower stem or branch or whatever you'd call that. People can't see it as I'm talking, but if they go look at it later, it's really a nice treatment of it. It actually reminds me a little bit of a painting. It's like an ancient Japanese painting called Hibiscus and Sparrow. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, and in fact, that was, I don't know if that exact image was one of my husband's inspiration, but those works are.
Oh, okay. And your husband's name? What's your husband's name?
His name is Mark DiBernardi.
DiBernardi, okay. So people can find his art?
Yeah, he has a nice website.
Okay. How do you spell DiBernardi?
DiBernardi.
Okay. I already mentioned a little earlier that you do talk about being a parent in the memoir, and I wonder what your advice is for listeners about talking to children about this subject, you know, keeping them safe but not scared.
I love that question. Let me see if I can answer succinctly, because I write about it in the book because it's been part of my journey as I was researching this book and learning more. Of course, I wanted to apply what I was learning to raising my own kids in terms of how to talk to them. No one talked to me about this at all, as was common in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I wanted to be like the poster girl for talking to my kids frankly and effectively about not just sexual abuse, but all kinds of matters relating to sexuality. And I found it more difficult than I had imagined, especially mm. with my son, who was mm. just resistant. But I made it happen. I tried to do it with as little clumsiness as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I had several chances, because as I write about in the book, unfortunately at his school, there were some ancillary staff members who were removed because of concerns. And it is just so important to talk to our kids from a very early age, to give them the names for their body parts, to tell them that no one but a parent or medical professional should be touching them there, that they can always tell if anyone has tried to. It's very important to ask them if anyone has tried to.
Yeah.
And to ask in such a way that it isn't immediately apparent that bolts of lightning will strike down and the world will change if they give a true answer.
Right.
Because many of us don't think to tell if we haven't been asked.
Right.
And I have seen with my friends' kids, our greater openness now seems to be having effects, because kids know more when to come to an adult, and hopefully before things escalate. Mm-hmm. I've known of several instances very closely where that's been the case.
Yeah. And it must be so hard for children who do have a parent molesting them to know who to talk to, or, you know, I mean, that's another situation,
right,
as well. I've interviewed Sue Williams Silverman, and I don't know if you're familiar with her story, but her father abused her.
Mm-hmm.
I loved that you talk in the book about being sort of gratified that your children cry, and that they maybe complain a little bit sometimes about things, and that you weren't somebody who cried a lot, and that you feel like that will ultimately protect them, because they'll be comfortable to complain about things.
Yeah, I hope so. You know, that's my hope.
Yeah. Okay. Zoe, what are you writing now?
I've just returned to a novel that I started writing in an in-between time with the memoir, and I'm just getting back into it as the promotion for this book is winding down.
Okay.
Completely different, set in the near future. It's fantastical, a little bit fantastical. So I'm released from the bonds of reality.
And it's fantastical, and who's your audience? Is it for adults?
It's for adults, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Cool. That sounds neat. How far are you into it?
I'm not very far. I've done a lot of thinking about it, but it's early stages.
Yeah. And you have another novel, Currency.
Right.
What was Currency about? I'm sorry, I haven't read that one.
Currency is about a young American woman who goes to Thailand, falls in love with a young Thai man, and together they become embroiled in an endangered animal smuggling scheme.
Oh, wow. That sounds
great. Also quite different from this book.
Yeah. Okay. And then can I ask, what are you reading lately, if you've had time on your tour to be reading, that you might recommend to people who are listening?
I just finished Gina Frangello's new novel, Every Kind of Wanting. And as I said, Gina and I work with each other's writing for years, so I've read it in manuscript a couple times, and it still blew me away in its final form. And I'm excited to read Abandon Me by Melissa Phoebos.
Okay.
And I'm rereading Station 11.
Oh, Station 11. Yeah,
that was
sort of fantastical and in the future,
yeah,
too. Yeah,
I'm reading it for that reason.
That's great. Now, that's interesting. So you don't avoid reading things that maybe have similar inspiration to what you're working on.
No, I don't have a rule about it. There came a point with writing the memoir, I read a lot of memoirs, and then I didn't want to read anymore. And
mm-hmm.
So I'm in the early stages now, so I'm really seeking out books set in kind of the near future. And then at some point, I probably won't be able to, I'll probably stay away.
Okay. Okay, great. I want to read one last line from the book and then ask you a question about it. You wrote, "Sitting in front of the computer, my eyes welled up with tears. The feelings came down, fear and anger and helplessness and sadness. Am I recollecting these emotions, or are they virgin, evoked by retrospective empathy?" I wonder if you can, as we finish up our conversation, can you offer advice for listeners who might be writing about their lives, and offer some advice about how to process emotion and memory as it comes up while they're writing?
Well, I can say what I did, which is I sometimes went away for weekends to write, and especially early on, there would be some considerable amount of time spent crying. And as I say in the book, I'm not a big crier at all. It's very uncomfortable for me. But it was a great release to let myself feel those things. I got back to the writing, and I know how scary it is to write about some of this very personal and painful stuff, but my experience has been, it's been an enormous relief to have it published.
Yeah.
I feel so much better. I feel so much more confident and light. And it took more energy to hold all that in than it takes to let people see it.
That's great. That's great. How has it been with your family since the book came out?
You mean my extended family?
I guess I meant your nuclear family, but yeah, your extended family too.
My nuclear family has been very supportive. My husband, you know, he did eventually read the book, really appreciated it, very supportive of all the running around I've been doing, and my kids too. People are sometimes interested in my kids' reaction to the book and what do I tell them about the book, and I've ended up telling them more than I expected to. Mm-hmm. My son is older, and I told him, he's a teenager now, I told him I didn't think he should read it now. I think he should maybe never read it or wait till he was an adult, because it's hard to read things about your parents' hard times. And he said he probably won't read it, and I thought that would be the case with him. But he's so sweet and supportive about it. And my daughter, too. My daughter's younger, but she knows the bare bones of what the book is about. She knows I was sexually abused, and she's also so sweet and supportive of me.
Yeah.
And I've ended up thinking, if my kids know this has happened to me and I'm a normal, functioning, happy, healthy person, there's less stigma if, God forbid, it should happen to them, or if one of their friends discloses something to them. I hope to take away some of the stigma that people who have been abused can feel.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, I'm going to just say one more time, the book is The Telling, a memoir by Zoe Zollbrod, published by Curbside Splendor. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
That, again, was a conversation with Zoe Zollbrod. If you'd like to read more about her work, her website is at Zoe, Z-O-E, Zollbrod, Zolbrod.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by our guest, Zoe Zollbrod. Write about telling a secret. Perhaps the first time that you told a certain important secret of your own. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And as I said earlier, if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. Have a great week.